Good morning. This is your morning news roundup. This program is presented by 20th Century Fox. This morning, in order that we may have the fullest reports from the invasion front, from other battlefronts, and the nation's capital, 20th Century Fox relinquishes its usual commercial announcement. We take you now to the NBC newsroom and Elmer Peterson.
We are making satisfactory progress in our invasion of the northern French coast. That's the latest official report from General Eisenhower's headquarters. We still haven't had any official details on the actual fighting areas, but here is a general picture as provided by frontline dispatches. The battle proceeds after our initial landings were successfully completed at several points along that 100-mile strip of Normandy coast in France. Our troops, who are being constantly reinforced, are fighting their way inland, up to 12 miles at some points. They are fighting in the streets of that old Gothic port city of Caen. The Germans admit that Le Havre, France's second seaport, is threatened by Allied troops attacking south of it, on the lower side of the Seine estuary. Some reports say that Allied troops in the Caen area have severed the Paris-Cherbourg railway. Allied tanks are said to be moving up to the Caen area. The third invasion communique, issued early this morning, said that Allied forces continued to land on the northern French coast. And the 8th Air Force in Britain has announced that a 50-mile-long train of gliders, towed by transports, have reinforced our troops on the Cherbourg Peninsula, a fantastic array of airborne power. The communique adds that enemy naval forces have made no further attempt at interference with our seaborne landings, that enemy coastal batteries still in operation are being bombarded by Allied warships, that Allied heavy bombers are attacking rail communications and bridges in the general battle area. There is increased air opposition, the communique adds. However, our fighter planes are patrolling every inch of our beachheads. 53 enemy planes have been destroyed. We have command of the skies. Important now are weather conditions in the English Channel. The latest report on this is that dawn broke over the Dover Strait with gray, cloudy skies. The sea on the British side of the strait was moderate, but it was blowing toward the French coast, where conditions would not be so smooth. However, we are continuing to land troops and equipment. The great parade of Allied ships has not halted. Our own Air Force yesterday flew no less than 13,000 sorties from dawn yesterday to dawn today. Last night, more than 1,000 heavy British bombers attacked German reinforcements moving up to the front lines. On the beachheads we have cleared, our engineers continue to hack out landing strips for succeeding waves of our own reinforcements. A German communique reports that our troops now have come into contact with German tactical reserves between Le Havre and Cherbourg. That's a very general statement, but it undoubtedly indicates that we are advancing at points considerably beyond the original beachheads. However, it does emphasize an important fact. We have successfully completed the first stage of the invasion, but only the first stage. The enemy has been waiting to determine the real direction of our attack, and he now will hit back. Today should see the start of the real test of our ability to keep going ahead. We now are entering a period requiring patience and a tight hold on over-optimism. German shore batteries, its plane, have not yet been entirely obliterated. The German Air Force should come into the battle more effectively. There will be a race in the matter of supplies for the opposing armies. Berlin dispatches via Stockholm say that 6 Allied airborne divisions, totaling 25,000 men, have been landed on the French invasion coast since the start of operations Tuesday morning, and say the Germans' dramatic fighting has developed between Allied airborne troops and German marching columns. These are enemy reports, but the fact remains that we must from now on expect increasing German counteraction. What worries the Germans is that General Eisenhower may start new offensives. In summoning in their reserves, the Germans must gamble on the direction of Allied strategy. They must take their own chances of weakening one point to strengthen another. In just a few seconds, we plan to bring you direct reports to fill in this picture of the invasion. Meantime, here are other war developments. In Italy, 5th Army infantrymen have pursued Kesselring's fleeing army to a point 10 miles north of Rome, and General Alexander says that the liberation of Italy is well underway. The Soviet Army newspaper Red Star said that Russia prepared now to join the final great offensive. And now for our direct reports from overseas. First, we hear from a battle area which found itself submerged in the rush of D-Day developments. We take you to NBC in Rome.
This is Ralph Howard speaking from Rome. The invasion of northern France continues to be the big news here in excited Rome. We've received little news of the progress of the expeditionary force, but just the meager knowledge that the invasion is going according to plan is keeping this city in an uproar. Although the advance of the 5th and 8th armies, which have once held the world's attention, is now relegated to minor importance, we are still fighting, and 5th Army forces have advanced 10 miles north of the city. The Nazis are striving desperately to delay our advance in some sectors and continue to form battle groups from various units. Opposition to our northward push is ferocious in some areas, while in others, small groups of Germans are timidly surrendering. As of yesterday, the 5th Army had taken 18,000 German prisoners. This figure apparently does not include the thousands of wounded Nazis left in hospitals in Rome. General Hume, commander of the Allied military government in the Rome area, held a press conference this morning and told us that the general situation in Rome is satisfactory. Electricity has been restored in most of the district. There is sufficient coal to provide gas. Purified by army engineers. The health situation here is good, and there's been no outbreaks of epidemics of any sort. Rome now has a population of over 2 million people, but many refugees from southern Italy are being assisted in their desire to return home. General Hume says the public safety situation is also good, and the people are welcoming back the Carabinieri. From Rome, I switch you now to NBC in London.
This is Stanley Richardson in London. The news in General Eisenhower's communique number 3, issued just 3 hours ago, is that satisfactory progress had been made in continued Allied landings which went on throughout yesterday on the northern French coast. It was announced for the first time that American Rangers and British commandos were participating in the assault, which appears to be going on ahead on a large scale. In addition to landing a steady stream of ground troops and supplies on the beachheads we hold, the Supreme Allied Command successfully sent across more airborne fighting units last night. Where and in what numbers they were landed behind the enemy lines was not disclosed, but the operation was officially described as successful. The Germans sought, by increased air activity and some reestablished coastal batteries, to stem the tide of the Allied onslaught. But in every case so far reported, their attempts at resistance were overwhelmed. They tried aerial attacks on our beach forces, and they endeavored to intercept our heavy bombers when they attacked communication lines and bridges in the general battle area. We shot down 42 enemy aircraft altogether and lost 14 bombers and 15 fighters in the action. Meanwhile, our air forces were otherwise occupied throughout the day, in attacking defended positions and other objectives in immediate support of Allied land operations. Fighter bombers and fighters at low altitudes strafed enemy units and motor truck columns moving toward the front. Thousands of aircraft from the American 8th and 9th Air Forces alone flew in operations during the 24-hour period ending today. And the official communique summed this all up in the terse comment that our air cover was again completely successful. Enemy naval forces made no further attempt to interfere with Allied seaborne landings on the beaches. But some shore batteries, which we originally had knocked out, but which apparently were restored to action, necessitated a continuation of our heavy naval bombardment from the sea. A Supreme Allied Headquarters spokesman acknowledged that this bombardment might have to continue for some time. It was revealed also that the enemy put up stiff resistance on the beaches in some areas during yesterday's first assault. This was in contrast to the almost total lack of opposition the Allied forces encountered in the movement towards the French coast. There was heavy fighting at some points, but by midday yesterday, most of our beachheads were free of direct enemy fire. Precautions already have been taken against any German attempt to move submarines from the Bay of Biscay into the English Channel for attacks on our sea communication and supply lines. And now back to NBC in New York.
And now we call in another NBC reporter located in a neutral city. We take you now to NBC's Bjorn Bjornsson in Stockholm, Sweden.
This is Bjorn Bjornsson speaking from Stockholm. The German radio and press this morning reflected the confusion into which the invasion has thrown the Nazi military leaders. The only front on which the Nazis now seem to be agreed is the propaganda front. One radio report from Berlin a short time ago was most confusing, no doubt deliberately so. It stated that no fighting has taken place in Caen. Also, that Le Havre has not been shelled. The Germans say that 52 American planes were shot down by flak on the first day. Then they add that the Luftwaffe didn't go up yesterday because of the bad weather. This they report blandly in the face of the fact that 11,000 Allied planes were reported in the air yesterday. Belying German confidence in their ability to repulse the invasion is the prediction, made both by press and radio, that the battle on the Normandy coast may last for days and even weeks. This is a positive indication that the Germans are doing a great deal of wishful thinking about turning back the invasion. A German report, which I received only a few minutes ago, states that heavy fighting is going on in the Seine sector from Cherbourg to Le Havre. Heavy battles were reported early this morning going on in the Carentan and Valognes areas, especially northeast of Bayeux. The Allies this morning were still holding the bridgehead in the Villars-sur-Mer and Aromance region, this report stated. It also indicated that the Allies are continuing to land new troops both by air and sea, especially at the Caen bridgehead. During yesterday, the Germans report, 6 Allied airborne divisions were landed. This report emphasized that Allied troops were getting a very hot reception. The Germans also claimed to have sunk a 7,000-ton troop transport. This report concluded by saying that the Allied troops were meeting experienced fighting men from the Eastern Front and that so far German reserves had not been touched. This is Bjorn Bjornsson in Stockholm, returning you to the NBC newsrooms in New York.
Bjorn Bjornsson in Stockholm has just given you his account of the confusion in Germany as the invasion of France proceeds. That confusion in Germany will spread, not only among the German people, but also among the German high command. It will spread especially when Russia comes in for her share of the final great attack on Germany. And Russia is now prepared to throw the great weight of the Red Army into this mounting offensive against Germany. That comes from the Red Star, the Soviet Army newspaper. This paper reports that a strong mounting attack of all the armies of the United Nations will be fully developed. The Great Armies goes on this paper, which at Tehran gave solemn promises not to make a separate peace, are beginning to move forward for a meeting in Berlin. Meantime, there's been a slackening, it seems, of German attacks in the 8-day battle near the Romanian city of Giassi. This is reported by Moscow, amidst these mounting indications that the Russian army is massing for a new offensive, which will in the end be fully coordinated with the Western invasion. Berlin itself obviously expects a new Russian westward thrust. In fact, one Nazi commentator said that a strong Soviet offensive army has taken action stations along the lower Dniester River. And there's also attention, now that our absorbing interest in the invasion relaxes a little to give us a better picture of world events, in the developments in the Pacific. The fighting in China still goes on. The Japanese are still struggling with their great offensive towards the Chinese cities of Changsha and Changte in their effort to get at the rice bowl of China. And Japan's crippled air arm has struck convulsively as Americans move steadily closer to a bitterly defended airfield in the Skouten Islands. However, the assault from the enemy's few remaining fighter bases in the Dutch New Guinea area was unsuccessful, according to an Allied headquarters communique. The Japanese planes twice attacked Allied positions, while an American column drove toward cliffs overlooking Mockner airstrip and those two neighboring landing fields on Biak Island. The raids were ineffective, and one plane was shot down. Meantime, Liberator bombers are still working in a broad offensive campaign from the air in the whole Pacific area. Boston attack planes wrecked several grounded enemy aircraft at Babo, on the Dutch New Guinea mainland south of Biak and destroyed two coastal vessels off Manapouri. A liberator on patrol shot down another Japanese plane. Hour by hour, the reports keep coming in of the invasion, plans as the invasion moves ahead. And now let's return for London for another report from NBC staff at the base of operations against Europe. These direct reports from close at the scene of action. Come in again. London.
This is London at 2:30 p.m. At this time, we hope to bring you another report by Merrill Muller, American broadcaster, covering General Eisenhower's headquarters somewhere in England. We now switch to a point somewhere near the command post. One moment, and then come in Merrill Muller.
This is Merrill Muller reporting from the Allied Advanced Command Post of the invasion forces. Down here, there's a small tent with a Tommy gunner always on guard. To it, in funnel fashion, come all the radio reports, courier dispatches, and carrier pigeons from the beachheads in France. It is the temporary war room of General Eisenhower's headquarters in the field. Even those of us attached to the command staff are not permitted inside the tent flap without a proper guide. On huge frames around the tent's interior are all the large-scale maps covering each of the beachheads made to date. Another map shows the disposition and movement, as reported, of enemy forces. Still another chart shows in considerable detail the powerful defenses our men broke through in consolidating the beaches. When the Supreme Commander wants the complete picture of hourly operations, he strolls quietly into this tent and studies each chart with great concentration. Those charts show the definitions of our beachheads, the regrouping of the enemy positions after the initial withdrawal of their forces from the beaches, and the developing areas of counterattacks. Yesterday, as you know, was a day of surprises. We certainly won a major victory in getting our tremendous forces ashore so cheaply, although all beaches were not as easily won as original reports indicate. Throughout the day, having failed to stop our avalanche pouring across the sands and into their beach defenses, the Germans started organizing local counterattacks. All of these were beaten off. Otherwise, today's communique could not report continued landings all along the front. The defeat of one such counterattack was an outstanding British action, of which more later. But guard against undue optimism. Remember this. We have only met locally organized countermeasures. In the next few days, we face the major all-out effort to throw us back into the sea. That effort is now in motion. But I do not know whether it has been engaged by our initial forces and the fresh landing forces behind us. I know the ground thoroughly over which we are now fighting. The Germans have several tactical advantages against us. First, they have high ground to withdraw into and again observe all our ground efforts against them and organize counteraction. Secondly, the Germans have considerable low rambling country in which to build massed tank assaults and then throw them against the beachhead in front of the hill. Likewise, the weather is hindering both sides. Inclement conditions over the battle area have kept the German Luftwaffe operations to a minimum and have saved our forces from considerable air reconnaissance and repeated bombing. But our air operations, despite the tremendous number of operational missions flown, is still of limited scope and success. At the same time, the weather, which hinders airplanes, is making the channel rough again today, and the surf is such as to make further landings of the build-up troops difficult, even without stiffening enemy opposition. But the navies are doing their job well. The next few days are critical. We have a foothold in France now. We have tremendous forces poised to be thrown into attack. But we must move by sea, whereas the enemy has faster lines of communication over land. He sees a thorn festering in his side. He is deploying his tremendous ground forces to strike it. Before operations started, I told you the enemy had upwards of 48 divisions scattered throughout France. So, as Admiral Ramsey said, we must mass our forces at the time and place that General Eisenhower and General Montgomery want them, and it must be done without a single hitch. The war is far from over. Its greatest phase has only begun. Think of those men in that beachhead, and think of what they are going through. Give them weapons, give them bonds, and give them blood, or at worst, sweat it out with them. While the political experts were condemning the lack of Anglo-American understanding and cooperation with General de Gaulle, a momentous conference took place here at the advanced command post. On the eve of the invasion, General de Gaulle, head of the French provisional government, was the guest of the supreme commander, General Eisenhower. They conferred at great length on the military operations then about to unfold. General Eisenhower later told me that he and General de Gaulle understood each other so well that they saw eye to eye on the operation. The two military figures did not discuss political aspects to which these operations will lead. But the presence of certain other figures in the party indicates that politics came in for a thorough airing, and with the right people. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, alleged champion of the restrict de Gaulle policy, brought de Gaulle to this headquarters for these discussions. With them was Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, the British representative to the provisional government, Alfred Duff Cooper. A most balanced judgment of affairs was indicated in the person of Field Marshal Jan Smuts, who also played a part here. The Allied Chief of Staff, General Biddle Smith, who recently at Allied headquarters spoke of cooperation with the provisional government, was at the meeting with French General Koenig, de Gaulle's observer to attach to this stand. In a military sense, then, de Gaulle's provisional government and its authority is more than recognized. On a liberation operation within Europe such as this, the military and the political are almost hand in glove. Thus, as I reported to you last week, de facto recognition here is practically de jure recognition later, at least for the period until France is so organized to elect her own government. And that may take 2 years. Now back to the United States.
This is London calling the United States. We will now have a broadcast of two film recordings made by George Wheeler, American reporter with the U.S. Navy, operating in the invasion of Europe.
General quarters. All hands, man your battle station. Man your battle station. This is George Wheeler speaking from the heavy cruiser, United States ship Augusta. It's 3:30 on the morning of Tuesday, June the 6th, just exactly 3 hours before H-hour. H-hour, as you understand, is the moment when the troops hit the beach. This is a curious moment in the lives of men. It's possible at a distance in time and in place to suppose many things, to over-dramatize the situation. You might, for example, think that there would be excessive gaiety among the men. There's not. Or you might, on the other hand, suppose that men would be sitting quietly counting over their secret thoughts. There's not that either. There's an extreme usualness about the behavior of everybody here. I think probably it's because everybody here is well trained. There's nothing amateur about this ship. George Wheeler, speaking from the command ship of the American forces involved in the invasion of France. The order has just been passed to commence firing as soon as we can bear on the target. In just one moment, you are going to know what it sounds like to hear a ship of war fire with you not more by microphone than 20 feet from that battery. It's going to be a blinding flash, just as there are blinding flashes from a battleship not more than 1,000 yards off our port bow. That battleship has been blazing away for the past few moments, for the past, to be exact, 25 minutes. And we have just come into the area where we can bear on the target and where we are also within range of the target. But in this operation, since there are a great many mines in this area, and since by this time, here we go, we're... That was a salvo of 8-inch guns from this heavy cruiser, the Augusta.
Another salvo.
A third salvo. Ladies and gentlemen of the United States, we are now in business.
You have just heard two recordings by George Wheeler, American broadcast reporter with the United States Navy. We return you now to the United States.
We take you now to the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And this is Leif Eade in Washington. This morning, Washington's big worry, official Washington that is that American home folks can't take it. They saw crowds of people going about their usual business yesterday when the invasion news broke. And this morning they're wondering whether our people are set to take the heavy casualties and the setbacks which are bound to come. They think perhaps the people have been kidding themselves into a false optimism about the weapons and men Eisenhower's marshaled for the invasion job, and think, now the beaches are won, it's a breeze from Normandy to Berlin. You caught that worry in the president's prayer when he said, the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed. And he told us in his invasion news conference, even this first operation isn't over. You just don't land on the beaches and walk in. There has to be a lot of hard fighting. Our war leaders here know the decisive moment hasn't been reached yet, not even at the beachhead. There's still the counterattack to come when Montgomery's lines are stretched to their thinnest and Rundstedt brings up more of his tough Nazi boys to meet the invaders. Incidentally, Secretary of War Simpson is telling Congress this morning when it comes to casualties, the infantry takes it the hardest. He points out in the Mediterranean fighting, infantry GIs were less than 20% of our troops, but they took 70% of the casualties. And the Secretary wants Congress to boost the pay of those infantrymen, the ones who hold the special distinctions the Army recently created. And up on Capitol Hill, both Republicans and Democrats agree the invasion will have profound effect on the November elections. Quick victory favors the Republicans. Tough fighting, with the possibility of a stalemate in France, would make people feel it's necessary to keep Mr. Roosevelt in the White House. And there's talk that if Germany collapses in 30 days, President Roosevelt would refuse to run for that fourth term. Otherwise, in Washington, a Senate House Conference Committee is trying for a quick compromise on the bill to extend the time for court-martialing our Pearl Harbor commanders for dereliction of duty. The Senate voted a year, the House only 3 months. And if you look closely, you can see a sharp political angle. And this is Leif Eade in Washington, and that's the news from here.
German broadcast today reported a new Allied amphibious landing attempt across the Straits of Dover. This is a very general report. It comes from enemy sources, and it should be taken with utmost caution. Another report from our supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force is that one of America's best-known major generals was demoted to lieutenant colonel and sent home for indicating in advance the time of D-Day. The supreme command allowed this information to be cabled abroad today after holding it up for several weeks for security reasons. The major general, and that's all we know about him, was one of the commanders in the American Air Force. As time goes on now, we're bound to see increasingly the results, psychological, political, economic, and military, of the invasion of France. We have one of those results today. For Portugal, it became today the first of the European neutrals to give full compliance to Allied requests for stopping vital war aid to the Nazis by imposing a complete ban on export and production of wolfram. This is Elmer Peterson speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.